This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is off this week. So we're here to talk about a case that went to trial last week. And joining us on the podcast is Trevor Savage, an attorney who works with us at Gideon Aysen. Welcome, Trevor.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Good to be on the podcast.
So Trevor, can you just give the listeners maybe kind of the 10,000-foot overview of what this case was about?
Yeah, so this was a medical malpractice case involving a missed PSA test. A PSA test is a test that's used to screen for prostate cancer. And basically, the 10,000-foot view is our client went to have an annual physical back in 2016. There was a PSA test that was highly elevated, and everyone ultimately agreed showed he had prostate cancer. The doctor who had ordered the test was away on vacation when the test came back to the hospital, and someone, no one knows who, stamped the test results as having been reviewed by the doctor when it wasn't. And essentially that set off an avalanche of mistakes that began in 2016 and ultimately resulted in this test going unnoticed essentially for 4.5 years, almost 5 years.
Yeah, that sounds correct to me, having been there with you at trial. So I want to go back a little bit. We're going to circle back to the trial, but so the folks know your background. You've been with us for how long now? It's all a blur.
9 months.
Wow. It seems like years, but we're in kind of a time warp. When you try cases, sometimes a day can seem like a week or so. But can you tell the folks what your background was prior to coming to work for our firm?
Yeah, absolutely. I did the defense work, actually. I did personal injury, medical malpractice defense work at a law firm in Portland for about 5 years, almost 5 years before I came over. And I forget who it was that was on this podcast, but I had a similar experience, but someone said they were doing defense work and they won a big motion for summary judgment. And I think they called their mom on the way home and their mom said, well, do you feel like you did justice? Do you feel like that's justice? And I forget who, I'm not giving proper credit, but that was sort of my experience as well, where it's a lot more satisfying and good for the soul to be on this side of the V than on the other side. And so your other associate, Merrill Poulin, recruited me for a period of time and I made the jump.
And do you think there's lessons you learned from your work as a defense lawyer that have been valuable in doing work on the plaintiff's side of the case?
Yeah, the most valuable thing, and it ties into what we experienced in this trial, in this case, which is that defendants and insurance adjusters and the decision makers at big corporations only respond to consistent advocacy, pushing the envelope, making sure that we're pushing them to trial and then 3 days into trial in this case before they'll actually take some accountability and make a meaningful offer to resolve a case. So They only respond to tenacity and strong lawyering, and we certainly learned that in this case.
This is the first time we've prepared a trial together, so you've experienced the full trial preparation, intensive experience that we go through to get the case ready and to try it. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was involved and what did you take away from that process?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a huge undertaking. Trying this case in particular had some really interesting and difficult causation issues that we had to overcome. And so, you know, there was a lot of pre-trial motion practice, and we can get into the facts of the case a little bit more, but there was a very narrow window of liability that we needed to get. And the briefing and the motions on that were very specific and very difficult issues. Then just, you know, making sure that we had all the witnesses squared away, flying experts in from across the country, staying up late, waiting for them to come in at 11 o'clock at night Eastern time and prepping them the night before. It was a huge undertaking.
And what about the case framing and opening statement?
Well, that's one of the benefits of doing this kind of work. And one of the reasons why I enjoy it much more than defense work is, so I did the opening statement for the case, and I probably did the opening statement 4 to 5 times. There were 4 or 5 different iterations of it for about a month and a half leading up to the trial. And it was when we would do the practices, you and Taylor and Merrill would be there, but all the paralegals, all the staff, to critique every single word, case framing, themes, delivery. My bet is that when I started working here back in January, no one thought they'd be hearing me talk to them about prostates quite as much as they did. They probably expected some prostate talk, but not quite as much as they ultimately got. It was a really great feeling having this group of people work with you over and over and over again to make sure we were doing the best possible case for our clients.
Yeah, and I have to say, it was a fairly tortured process that went on a long time, and you have to have a thick skin in order to handle that, because you're getting a lot of feedback and criticism. But the net result of that was really terrific. Your opening at trial was fantastic. I think we cut it down to just about 30 minutes, and it was clear, it was concise, it was very compelling, it was thematic in a way that it was very clear what you were arguing and what we were planning to prove at the trial. There were not a lot of wasted words or wasted facts. It was repetitive in a certain way that was, I thought, very effective. And then the use of graphics, you had a timeline. Do you want to explain the timeline? That's one thing that maybe didn't go exactly as we would have hoped, but I think we found a way to make it work.
Yeah, the timeline was, and I won't take credit for it because the timeline was your idea. I don't want listeners or viewers to think that I'm taking credit for something I didn't do. But essentially, as I mentioned, the case was an almost 5-year delayed diagnosis and treatment of prostate cancer. And it became, when we focus grouped the case, it became clear that the people who did the focus groups with us lost track of where we were in the story pretty frequently. What time was this? When did this doctor do X? When did the other doctor do Y?
One issue with that is that there were multiple different doctors in different offices.
Yeah, different doctors in different offices over the course of 5 years. So unless you really knew the case like we did, with things that were obvious to us were not obvious to folks in focus groups and certainly to a jury. So what we did was we created a 5-year timeline of events, starting on the far left at the beginning, the missed test in January 2016. Going all the way to the far right in 2020, showing here's when a different doctor finally raised the flag on this issue and our client had his prostatectomy done. And we broke the timeline into year increments. So there was a 2016 foam core board, a 2017 board, 2018, 2019, 2020, and they all connected to represent one timeline. And so what we did was, as I was telling the story of what happened in this case, I would put up one board representing a single year at a time. And so that way, as I went through the case, here's what happened in 2016. Okay, here's now what happened in 2017. and on and on and on. And that gave, I think, the jury an understanding of the full gravity of what happened over the course of this 5 years. And then we also had a graphic at the bottom of demonstrative at the bottom of each of the timelines showing the progression of the prostate cancer that everyone agreed was there in 2016. The cancer cells multiplying, getting bigger and bigger from 2016, 17, 18, and through 2020.
Yeah, I thought the timeline was very effective, and there's a way it really encapsulated everything we were saying about the case onto one exhibit, one demonstrative. And as you explained, what we were trying to accomplish, probably the single biggest fact in the case, perhaps what the Mark Mandel will call the "I just can't get over it" fact. There were probably two. One was that the doctors, somebody stamped the test as reviewed by the doctor, even though the doctor didn't actually review it, so it didn't get acted upon. But the other thing was just the period of delay, almost half a decade long. And the defense was that that didn't make any difference. And nobody, intuitively, that's not something people are inclined to believe. But we wanted to really viscerally communicate that time period. And of course, you're not going to be able to relive the events in real time. Otherwise, the trial would go on 4.5 years. So how do you convey this long time lapse in a short period of time in a 30-minute opening? And we did that by, as you explained, having a different board for each year. And then you made a very effective production out of the transition from 1 year to the next. We're now moving to a whole nother year. We're in 2017 now. And then you talk about that year. And then at some point, we're moving to 2018. But it really just, it connected the delay to some kind of visceral feeling with the exhibit that we were using in a way I thought was pretty effective. The listeners may be thinking, well, the way you've described the case seems kind of like a no-brainer. I mean, they missed this test result in 2016, and there was a more than 4.5 year delay in diagnosing this gentleman's prostate cancer. So that sounds like a slam dunk. Were there problems with the case that we had to overcome to obtain a result here?
Yeah, I mean, the big problem in the case was, so for listeners, Maine has 3-year statute of limitations, and we don't have the discovery rule, which means that the statute of limitations starts ticking on the date of the negligence, regardless of whether the patient knows there was any negligence at all by the doctor. And so the problem in this case is, this is before my time, but this case came into us, and Ben, you can correct me, in the summer of 2021. And so, you know, Ben and Taylor filed the case very soon after it came in the door. But the problem was that all the negligence in 2016, the stamping of the test results, that wasn't as being reviewed by the doctor when it wasn't, that was all long after the statute of limitations had already run. That was about 5 years earlier at that point. And so initially that was the problem with the case, which was that there was this multiple instances of negligence by the hospital and by different doctors that was before 2018, when that's where the 3-year statute of limitations goes into play. And so initially, I think the hospital wasn't inclined to really take the case seriously because of that statute of limitations issue. So, and again, this is before my time, but Ben and Taylor argued and briefed the issue of, this is a continuing negligent treatment case, meaning as long as we can allege one instance of negligence within the 3-year statute of limitations, that is one instance of several related course of treatments, then if you can get that one date of negligence within the statute, everything else beforehand comes in as well. And so ultimately, there were, I think, 5 different dates of negligence. There was one in January 16, there was one in April of 2017, there was one in April of 2018, and then there was one in September of 2018, so 4. And the September of 2018 negligence, as we alleged, that was the only date of negligence that was within the 3-year statute of limitations. And so what that meant was, unless we could prove negligence on that date, we would lose. The jury wouldn't get to consider all the other negligence that was alleged and proven at trial.
Yeah, that was a difficult issue. So when the case first came in, one of the issues that was that the acts of negligence that occurred, well, the one date within the 3 years, as you point out, September of 2018, was an act or omission of a different medical provider, a different doctor, individual doctor, than the acts or omissions that occurred in 2016. Because what happens is our client's doctor's office had been closed by the business, and they had forced him to transfer his care to a different office within the same system. And the doctor, his original doctor, was no longer with the company. And so he lost his primary care doctor. So this was really a case of first impression in the state of Maine as to whether continuing negligence could apply where it's the same medical provider, the same healthcare company, but different individual doctors or different individual medical personnel that were involved in the care. And we felt strongly that, number one, it did apply to that. Number two, that it should apply to that, because the way medicine is practiced these days, it's practiced on a corporate level. And, you know, when you go into your primary care, to some extent, it's arbitrary who you're going to see on a particular date. And those decisions are made by the business. They're not made by the patient most often. So that was a subject of summary judgment, and we prevailed on that, which was a great decision because it really now clarifies that issue going forward and should allow other claimants the opportunity to access continuing negligence in cases where the same company has provided the care both before the statute and after the statute. So that was a big obstacle we had to overcome. But as you're correct, even at the end of the case, at trial, we were still going to have to prove negligence with respect to that date in 2018, which was, I felt that we had a strong claim for that date, but it wasn't quite as powerful as the negligence claims for some of the earlier dates. And it certainly, there was a risk that the jury might feel like they were siding with the plaintiff and finding for us on multiple different dates, but then giving the defense one on the only one date that mattered if the jury didn't know that was the date that was critical for the case. Now, we never got to that point because this case settled midstream, sort of close to the end of our case in chief, before closing arguments, before the jury deliberated. And that was one variable. There was some uncertainty about how the jury would be instructed and what they would have to find. And that was a factor in deciding to settle the case before the verdict. This is a case that I think you said one of the takeaways for you is just that the aggressive litigation presentation of the evidence and demonstrating your willingness to try the case and to go to verdict if needed is what allowed this case to settle in the way that it did. Do you want to kind of go back over the history of that and how we got to where we were?
Yeah. I mean, when we mediated the case, well, even before mediation, when initially, while their motion for summary judgment was pending, my understanding is that we made an offer to settle the case because of the uncertainty on the law about different providers, whether that was continuing negligent treatment. You know, an offer for $800,000 at that time. And I think ultimately we would have taken less than that because there was that uncertainty. And the insurance company and defense counsel didn't take it seriously and basically said, no, we're not going to respond to that. We'll continue on. So after we won the motion for summary judgment and the case continued again in mediation, they didn't take it seriously. We didn't get to what we thought was a reasonable value at all in the case. And when you look at the case over a period of time, there were multiple instances where they could have settled for a lower amount and ultimately elected not to. And I think one of the real benefits for us was we did a data study of this case, which sort of showed empirically how juries would value the case, our win rate, and all of that. And so as the process was going on, the defendant was sort of relying on their own gut instincts of case value, their own subjective view of here's how much this case is worth. And we had the value of empirical data showing how much the case was worth. And we only would have got the result that we did by pushing the case, by bringing it into court, by rejecting all of their offers to settle, you know, their numerous offers over the course of the case. I think right before trial, we had an offer of judgment for $3 million. And the data told us that wouldn't be in our client's best interest to settle. So that's not an easy decision, because that would have put a lot of money in our client's pockets. It would have guarded against the risk that our evidence didn't go in as well as it ultimately did. But having the data study to tell us everything that the defense attorney is offering is not good enough right now, it was really helpful in pushing the case forward. And then ultimately, I don't think that we would have got the result that we did if the evidence hadn't gone in as well as it did. And part of that is the strength of the case. And part of that is because, you know, we had really great trial presentation. Our experts were fantastic. They were very effective on the stand. But this is a case where the defendant and the insurance company and the risk management, they would not have taken the case as seriously as they ultimately did if we hadn't pushed the envelope and brought them 3 days into trial.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. It's proven by what actually happened. So the outcome kind of speaks for itself in that regard. But I think the data study is an interesting point that you make about that. So this is something I know our listeners have heard from other lawyers like Sean Claggett, and they've heard from John Campo, who we work with to do this data analysis. I thought it was very helpful in this case for a couple reasons. One is it really did give us a sense for what a reasonable valuation for the case would be, not based on our own perhaps misguided instincts or past experience, but based on actual demographically similar jurors. I think we had 400 some odd people who did the data study, so it was a pretty large statistical sample. One of the things I did with that, which is not something I've done before, but I actually sent the top line findings to the risk manager for the defense in this case, because I wanted them to understand what their risks were in a real way. And although that didn't net us the result we wanted pre-trial, I really do think that laid the background for the result we were ultimately able to get once they saw how the evidence was coming in the case. It also, frankly, gave us a lot of confidence and a lot of cover with our own client to recommend turning down the $3 million and proceeding to trial, because we had an objective basis to say that's just not a good number for this case. And we shared the data study with our own client. They had the benefit of that information, so they're able to make informed decisions about their own case based on having information. So I think it's really valuable for a lot of reasons. The other thing we gained from the data study was we were able to really do a pretty good job of profiling who we wanted on the jury. In this case, we had supplemental juror questionnaires that were pretty extensive, so we had a lot of data from the actual jurors. And we structured our data study so we asked the focus group jurors all the same questions that were on the supplemental juror questionnaire. And then we worked with actually Alicia Campbell to rank. So first they would figure out which of the categories was statistically significant in either identifying a positive or negative juror for us. And in many cases, we've done several of these before, there often are not that many predictors. You know, there could be one or two in a case, but in this case, there were about 10 different predictors. And so we assigned each of those categories a value. So they could be a plus one or a minus one, depending on if they were a negative predictor or a positive predictor. And what's interesting is that some of the categories can be both negative and positive. For instance, one category was whether people listened to NPR, and that was positive on liability, but negative on damages. In other words, people who listen to NPR might be about 10% better for us for the win rate, but 10% worse for us on damages figures. So that's just one example. We didn't use that particular category in profiling our jurors. So I thought that was pretty interesting and effective way to make rational decisions about who you want on your jury. And it was interesting when we did our peremptory challenges, we had everybody ranked. I think by that time we had several jurors. We got removed for cause based on their answers and oral questioning. But when we were left to the final peremptories, we were able to eliminate a couple people that we had pinned as like negative threes or negative twos. But the defense actually used two of their peremptories to eliminate people we had pinned as negative jurors. So they did not have that kind of data. They were not working with the same level, the data set we had. And as a consequence of that, I think they made potentially some bad strategic choices in terms of who they selected on the jury. So why don't you talk a little bit about how the evidence came in, Trevor? I mean, I agree with you that it came exceptionally well for us. What do you think were the kind of high points, potentially low points of that, if there were low points?
Yeah. So one thing just to say for context is originally we hadn't planned on call. So the trial began on a Monday. We did jury selection and then openings on Monday. And originally we weren't planning on calling any witnesses that day. And the judge made clear to us in one of our pretrial conferences that he didn't find that a terribly good use of court resources. So we said, okay, we'll call someone. So we had two people to pick from, and one was our client's pastor, who was an incredibly likable, charismatic person who was going to be a good character witness for our clients. And ultimately, we decided not to call him because one of the things the data study showed was that both win rate and damages dramatically increased when the juror was a person of faith, when they weren't agnostic or atheist. And one concern for us in that process was if we did call him as a witness, the pastor, then there might be in the jury selection process, people would be removed for cause because they knew him or went to his church. And that wasn't something that would be helpful for us. And so we had to make the difficult decision on the eve of trial not to call this person who we thought would be this great character witness. So we ultimately called our client's son, who's about, I think, 32 or 30, as a first witness, which wasn't how we planned it. We originally planned to call our first witnesses would be the negligent doctors, followed by our client, and then sort of get into the experts from there. And we made the decision to call the son. First of all, it couldn't have been more clear that of all the places that he wanted to be in the world, a courtroom wearing a blazer was not one of them. But he answered every question earnestly and honestly. And he came across as a really effective witness in ways that, you know, the pastor who is really well-spoken might not have in that same way. And so just from the beginning, having our client's son come up and talk about, look, my father, this is who my father is. He's a mechanic. You can trust him to take care of your car. And he trusted these doctors to take care of him, and they failed him. That was a great way for the evidence to begin. And it wasn't, maybe Ben will claim that he had planned that all along, but I certainly had it of having the evidence come in that way.
Yeah. I mean, so just to that point, I mean, to set the stage a little bit, first of all, in the data study, I did share this with the defense folks, so this is no surprise to anybody, but our win rate in the data study was actually only about 62%. So although this sounds like potentially a slam dunk case, and I think ultimately it was the way we presented it, and we often bend over backwards when we do the data study to put the best foot forward for the defense and make kind of all inferences in their favor so that we're not getting overly optimistic results. And we want to be able to rely on them. But one of the reasons for that 60-40 win rate, well, one of them was that we didn't tell the jury about the significance of the September 2018 date. So we considered it a loss if they found for us negligence on every other date, but they found no negligence on that September date without knowing one way or the other that that was going to affect the outcome. Secondly, though, in the data study, we represented as part of the defense statement that our client had been informed of his test result, not when he had the elevated PSA in 2016, but when he returned for his annual physical in April of 2017, that he was told about the elevated result, that he was counseled about its significance, and that the doctor at that time ordered repeat testing for him, and then he blew that testing off. He never went to get it. And a combination of those factors, I think, is what resulted in us not having a higher win rate. So a 60, that means 4 out of 10 times, according to the data study, we were going to lose this case. So now, with that framework in mind, and you think about the testimony of the son, who Trevor put on brilliantly, I might add, it was a very effective witness and a great examination. You really prepared him very well. But our client is probably 6'3", 6'4", a big, tough, strapping male auto mechanic. That's our client. His son is literally a splitting image of that. He's 6'3", 6'4", big, tough, muscular looking guy, spent his life snowmobiling, hunting, fishing. He's just one of these salt of the earth kind of main guys. He works as a custodian at the local school district. And so one of the questions would be, we knew would be, would our client be the kind of guy who might be told, well, you have a test that shows you have cancer, you might have cancer, and I'm just going to ignore that and not follow up on it and blow it off. And we didn't ask the son about those things, but you did ask him things about how Michael was in terms of his approach to the job he did do, the mechanics, and how scrupulous he was, how detail-oriented he was, how important it was to him to get the job done right, and the idea that people would rely on him for their safety when they would leave the shop and they would have to drive the truck or the, I mean, he actually worked on race cars, that people would drive around a track at high speeds, that it would be critical that you would be detail-oriented and conscientious. And so we got that kind of case frame that Michael was a super conscientious person, safety-minded, and all of those things, without once ever talking to his son about whether his dad would have followed up for a prostate cancer test. So I thought that was really effective. And then just the, yeah, as you point out, the earnestness of him and our client, Michael, as you might expect, although he had been through a lot, he wasn't the best at talking about it himself. He would tend to minimize the impacts on himself, but his son did not. His son basically told it like it was. My dad used to be a really active guy who was always there for you, who could get up on a roof and put on shingles. He would be there at a moment's notice to do anything with his grandchildren. And now he's lying in bed all day. He has no energy and, you know, he's lost his job and he's just not the dad I used to know. He's not the person I used to know. It was much more effective coming from his son, really, than from him. And his son told that story in a way he wouldn't have been able to tell it himself. And in a very credible way, too, I thought.
Yeah, and as you said, it also set the stage for then when the next day when you hear from the doctors, and the doctor who claims that he had counseled Michael about the PSA test, told him about the abnormal result, ordered new tests. When the jury saw him come up and say, oh, I don't remember, but my custom and practice would have been to do that. And then Michael comes on and says in no uncertain terms, he never told me anything. And then you find out afterward that, you know, once he does finally hear about this in 2020, that immediately he goes gets a repeat PSA, immediately he goes to a urologist. The jury's already sort of decided that this is the way it must have been. The best evidence of what Michael would have done when he heard about the results is what he did do when he heard about the results. And I think having Michael's son Brian set the stage for that was really helpful.
Yeah, it turned out to be, it wouldn't have been how I would have normally planned to start a trial. I mean, typically what I like to do for the first witness is either put on a causation witness who can explain the medicine and the science. And I like doing that because that's what raises the stakes and the jury understands why doing the right thing in terms of the medical care and treatment is so important, because they already know now after first witness, if they don't, this is what's going to happen. And that first witness can also explain the anatomy and the physiology and just teach the jury what they need to know. So often in medical cases, sometimes call that causation first, and that's often my approach. However, I don't do that in cases where there may be more complicated causation issues, but very powerful and very clear negligence, because then I want to lead with my strongest suit, which in this case is the negligence. And in this case, it was the outrageous conduct of allowing a non-licensed, non-qualified person to review the patient's test results, stamp them as having been reviewed by the doctor, and then shoving them in the file with nobody else ever looking at them for 4.5 years. I mean, that is the issue nobody can excuse and nobody can get over that. So I really wanted to start the case with that and not with the causation issue, which was a little bit more complicated here. But actually being forced to start it with a really great damages slash character witness was even better, because then that actually had the effect of raising the stakes. And by the time they heard about that egregious misconduct on day two of the trial, they understood why that mattered, why that was so significant here. So I thought that ended up being quite effective. It's a tricky one, because that worked well because we happen to have a great witness who could fulfill that role. And if you don't have that, it may not be the best strategy, but it definitely worked well for us here.
We should also be open and honest with the listeners. Part of the reason we didn't have a plan witness for that Monday is because we had hoped to get more time for jury selection. We had hoped to have to be able to say to the court, look, there's no witnesses today. We can go all day if we want to on this.
Right. And as you said, after the conference with the court, the judge saw through that little tactic because I'm well known in Maine as pushing the envelope on trying to get additional access to attorney voir dire. And this judge has been terrific, by the way, and has permitted us to do voir dire in the last 3 trials we've done with him, but he's limited us to, in this case, 45 minutes. So I wish Rahul were here. We could joke around about that, because Rahul spends 45 minutes per juror. I've watched one of his voir dires again in the lead up to doing this trial, just to remind myself what to do. But yeah, I mean, when you only have 45 minutes and he had 25 jurors in the box, it's really difficult to, number one, hear from everybody. Number two, get any useful information. Number three, drill down enough with any individual juror to establish cause challenges. So I thought we were pretty effective in doing the most we could with that 45 minutes. But we had been hopeful that if we didn't have a witness for Monday, the judge might have said, well, we might as well let them do a couple more hours of voir dire because we don't have anybody scheduled anyway. But it didn't work out that way. Talk about the causation. The defense, although they certainly argued the blame the patient angle here with Mike not following up on what they claimed was the information they reported to him about his test result and the repeat test, really they seemed more in this case to want to live or die on the hill of causation. So tell the listeners, what was their argument there and what was their strategy for how they were going to approach that?
Yeah, so it's helpful to back up a little bit. Our theory of the case is that in 2016, when they spotted this PSA test and everyone agrees he had cancer at that time, then he would have been treated with a radical prostatectomy, just removing his prostate. And so the difference in damages for the case is what his outlook and symptoms would have been if they had just removed his prostate in 2016 versus what ultimately happened, which was in 2020, they removed the prostate. And then because removing the prostate didn't get all the cancer, then they had to put him on 2 years of androgen deprivation therapy to suppress his testosterone. They had to do sort of targeted radiation therapy. And that resulted in permanent incontinence, impotence, as Ben alluded to, you know, the fatigue from all that treatment caused him to lose his job, things like that. And so the theory of their case was that because his PSA level, it was 12.7 in 2016. The theory of their case was that, well, if it was 12.7 in 2016, and then once they ultimately found the cancer in 2020, his PSA was 12.4. And so their theory was, well, because the PSA is the same, that means the cancer must have been the same in both instances, meaning it had already gotten outside of the prostate in 2016 anyway. So even if they had caught this in 2016, they would have done the same thing they did in 2020, remove the prostate, testosterone deprivation, and radiation. And part of what we had going for us in this case is that jurors, and we saw this in the focus groups, we saw this in the data study, jurors are sort of socially programmed not to believe that argument, not to believe that a five-year delay in diagnosing and treating cancer makes no difference whatsoever. And so we had that going for us, a wind at our backs on that issue. But you're right, they did decide really to make that the theme of their case. And they hired an oncologist who, you know, is very well credentialed, makes a remarkable amount of money doing what he does, to come in and say that there is a correlation between PSA levels and the progression of cancer. And that because the PSA was the same in both times, the cancer hadn't spread. And again, an oncologist, he's someone that sees cancer at later stages. He sees it later on in the process. Our expert was a urologist. He's someone that I think he performs over 100 prostatectomies or around 100 prostatectomies a year. He does prostate biopsies. He does all these things. And so from a credibility perspective, we really had the better argument because all along we could say everyone agrees here that if they had spotted this test that they missed, they would have referred him to a urologist immediately. Oh, and by the way, our expert's a urologist and he'll explain what he would have done. And there's sort of a built-in credibility to that versus having an oncologist who only sees patients later on, for the most part. What we sort of realized in the case was that we understood why he was making the arguments that he did, which is essentially that the prostate has sort of a baseline PSA. There are proteins that are associated with the prostate that are in the system anyway, as long as you have a prostate, and that their expert, once you remove the prostate, any change in PSA is attributable only to cancer. And because that's what their expert sees on a day-to-day basis, that's how he viewed the case. And unfortunately for everyone, including the jury, we never got to see Ben cross-examine their expert on that issue because the case settled before that happened. But that was a really important distinction, and we were able to highlight that distinction when we put on our own causation expert.
Right. And just to flesh that issue out a little bit more, so their causation expert, the medical oncologist, is a guy who's a full professor at Harvard and is one of the probably leading academics on prostate cancer in the country. But primarily what he writes about and studies, as Trevor alluded to, is treatment of metastatic disease after the cancer has spread outside the region to other parts of the body. And his expertise is really on the what types of chemotherapy would be most effective in treating that. Our client's disease never became distantly metastatic. It had spread regionally to his lymph node outside of his prostate, to the bladder, to the seminal vesicles, but it had not spread, at least as far as we know as of today, has not spread, and I hope that remains the case, to any other parts of his body. So he did not have distant metastasis. The other element of a prostate cancer case that I'm sure any of our listeners who do this kind of work have encountered is, unlike many types of cancer, prostate cancer generally does spread slowly. So typically, you need a longer period of delay in order to prove that the delay makes a difference. So in some cancers, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months might make a difference. Generally, with prostate cancer, it doesn't. These cancers grow over a longer period of time. But how quickly they grow is really dependent on the individual strain of the cancer and how aggressive it is. So in our client, in this case, everybody agreed had a sort of intermediate risk cancer. So it was not the kind that you would sit around watchful waiting, because this is a kind that's known to grow over time. And Trevor's correct. We never got to the point in the trial where we were going to play the testimony of their expert. However, because their expert was unavailable to come and testify in person, we had already done the trial deposition of their expert before we started trial, and I had already done my cross of him. And I think that whatever confidence they had that they were going to win this case on causation, I think that was pretty much gone after the cross of their expert, because he did not perform well on cross-examination. I think we scored all of the points we needed to call his opinions into serious doubt. The other thing I thought was interesting in terms of what Trevor was alluding to in the jurors, their own pre-existing beliefs, was that in our data study, even though we presented the opinions of their expert extensively and argued the causation for the defense the same way they were planning to argue it at trial, virtually none of the focus group jurors believed that. People were just not willing to accept that an almost 5-year delay didn't make a difference. And it was to the point where that was not an issue. The narrative summary that John and Alicia Campbell provided to us, the top line summary of that issue was, you don't need to worry about causation. It's not an issue, which is pretty interesting given that from the defense standpoint, they thought that that was a huge issue and they thought that was the issue. But it actually wasn't an issue at all. And so I think we changed our opening, we changed our presentation quite a bit, recognizing the confidence and strength we had in that issue. And we did not overdo it. And you mentioned that they had an expert in the opening, and you maybe gave a sentence about why we think that's not correct. But we really didn't even glorify that by making a big deal out of it, because we knew jurors were not likely to accept that argument.
Yeah, and In the opening, I said they have an expert who will say that a 5-year delay made no difference. You'll hear the evidence. You'll decide if that makes sense to you. And that's all we had to say, because like you said, the focus groups in the data study have told us they're already conditioned to think that makes no sense whatsoever. This is a hospital trying to cover its butt by hiring an oncologist to say something.
I tried to think of a way to keep it really simple and to access jurors' pre-existing beliefs about that. And I actually took this from a presentation I saw Mark Lanier give in crossing an expert in one of his recent trials. I'm blanking on which one it was. But what I wanted to do is get a very simple kind of yes or no question or series of questions that could tee up that issue and show the differences of view here between the plaintiff and defense side of the case. And so during the cross of Dr. Smith, their oncology expert, we had two slides that we used during the examination. One of them said simply that cancer that is undiagnosed and untreated continues to grow and spread. Do you agree, yes or no? And he said no. And then the second one was early treatment of cancer
reduces
the likelihood that the cancer will continue to grow or spread, yes or no? And he said no. So, and we had that on the screen and we had the box no checked off. And then at trial, so first of all, in voir dire, I asked all the jurors those exact same questions with using the same slides. And every single juror said yes. Not a single juror said no. And then with each witness, each of the medical witnesses, we asked them the same questions. So their doctors, the treating doctors, they all said yes. We didn't use the slides necessarily with every one of our own experts, but they all said yes. Even their liability expert, who you deposed, Trevor, you asked him, and he said yes, somewhat grudgingly, but he said yes. So in the closing, which I unfortunately was not able to give since the case ended before we closed, one of our points about their causation expert was that every single person on this jury and every single doctor you've heard from in this case agrees with these two basic principles relating to how cancer grows and spreads and the importance of early diagnosis and treatment. Every expert except for one, the one who's paid, you know, over $100,000 a year to come into cases like this and to say that half a decade of delay in diagnosing and treating a patient's cancer doesn't make any difference. So I think that he was pretty much done after that. And there were other things that we did with him, but I think that alone was probably enough to cast serious doubt on anything that came next for him. So I think pushing up over the anybody's tolerance for a podcast, we're almost at an hour, but big picture takeaways. And I guess I should just say it was a little bittersweet to settle this case because we ended up getting a great result for our client, and it's going to make a huge difference in his life and the life of his family. And I feel very good about creating value for him, not just overcoming the legal obstacles, but the way we prepared the case, the way we were willing to turn down, you know, a substantial amount of money and try the case to get a better result for him. But you still come away with it a little bit saddened that we didn't get our verdict. One of my friends who was trying to make me feel better about it gave me the old adage that settlements feed families and verdicts feed egos. And it's important to keep that in mind and why we're really doing this. But it was a little, you know, sad not to be able to see it all the way through to the end and get the verdict that I'm confident would have come out very well for us. But in the final few minutes we have, big picture takeaways for you.
I think the biggest picture, and yeah, I experienced the same sort of grieving process, if you will, of the verdicts that could have been, because you're right. I fully expected that too. And understanding that it was my own ego and hubris that wanted the big verdict, knowing that we gave got an incredible result for our client. That's what matters. And reminding myself of that was really helpful. Big picture though, I think really just the way we were able to marry the exhibits used during the depositions with the data study, with the jury selection, with the case themes. Everything sort of built on top of one another, like you just mentioned, even just the exhibits, cancer that remains undiagnosed and untreated continues to grow and to spread. That was something that we just included in the focus groups. We included that in the data study. You used that to inform our decision-making during jury selection. And then we were able to use that as a theme throughout the trial. So making sure that there was sort of a string attaching each one of those issues throughout the process. And I think that gave us some certainty as far as the arguments we were making. We went into the trial knowing the jury's going to buy this argument. They won't buy that one. We need to emphasize this. We don't have to worry about that one. And when you come in from that perspective with the benefit of the data study and the data study usage in picking a jury, that gives you a lot of confidence. And we knew that we had a better grasp on the issues and the tipping points in the case than the defense did. And there's real power in that.
Yeah, I agree. So I was never able to actually give the closing argument at trial, but I did give the
closing. Are you going to give it now?
I'm not going to give it now, but I did actually do a version of the closing argument the weekend before the trial in New York City at the Trial Lawyer University conference there. And if anybody's interested and you are a user, registered participant in TLU, I think that's probably online and you can access that. So you can, I think I did a 30-minute version of the closing and wasn't 100% complete, but it gives you kind of the gist of what the closing would have looked like. And it was all in the can and ready to go. So it was sad that we weren't able to do it, but ultimately very happy with the result we were able to achieve for our client. And it was really great to try this case with you, Trevor. You did an amazing job, and it's great to have you as part of the team. And hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast for future cases and future verdicts that we're going to get together. So thanks for doing that, and thanks for doing this today.
Thanks, Ben. Let's get ready for the next one.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.